We are glad to make all of our JCast Network podcasts free for our listeners. However, they are not free to produce and host. Please consider making a donation to JCast Network to help support our work by visiting jcastnetwork.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We have got a great show for you today. In this half hour, we'll be doing a rebroadcast with Yiddish scholar and lecturer who will be teaching a class at Jewish Ferndale starting next month. That would be Nachum Eichenhorn. Very scholarly, but very entertaining interview from what I remember. We have a wonderful assortment of Jewish music sprinkled throughout the show. The portion of the week is the portion of Vayechi. We are ending the book of Genesis. Next week, we're going into the Exodus. Yes, that's the thick Bible stuff. That's where it gets really like, whoa, like, hold on. Oh, wonderful Hasidic story at the end. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. A 24-year-old Palestinian man was shot and killed by IDF forces during riots near the Gaza-Israel border. Protesters marched following Friday's prayers near the border fence in response to calls from Hamas for a third Friday of Rage in protest of President Donald Trump's announcement early this month recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. 35 people were arrested during riots last Tuesday to protest Vice President Pence's visit to Israel. Pence was in Washington at the time as he was needed to help the tax bill. His visit was rescheduled for next month. The Palestinians decided to riot anyway. The UN General Assembly passed a resolution rejecting any recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. The vote was 128-9 with 35 abstentions. Those 43 countries that participated against the 128 were invited to a party held by UN Ambassador Nikki Haley. How do you like that one? President Trump commuted the sentence of Shalom Rabashin. We've been following this story since the last 12 years. Shalom Rabashin was the chief executive of what was then the largest kosher slaughterhouse in the country, who was convicted of bank fraud and money laundering charges in 2009. Rabashkin was sentenced to 27 years in prison. Juan Thompson was sentenced to 5 years in prison for making bomb threats against Jewish institutions as part of a revenge plot against a former girlfriend. The judge gave him more than recommended sentence, saying that Thompson had committed domestic terrorism. And finally, little interesting news, you get to boast the gift of two worlds over here, the Technion, Israel Institute of Technology, became the first Israel university to open a campus in China. The school will offer programs in engineering and science. So now you can do Israel and China both at the same time. It's a good thing. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Joel Finman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have online noted Yiddish scholar Nachum Eichenhorn, who is now making his home in Detroit, as he did when he was a kid, back again to the homeland. How are you, Nachum?
I'm doing well, Rabbi. How are you?
Good, thank God, Baruch Hashem, as we say. Okay, let's talk some history before we get into anything else. The development of a language is like really a very fascinating thing. And here it is. You have Jews, you know, we have the expression the wandering Jew. There's a plant called the wandering Jew, which sends out its little things and all over the place. So Jews were living in something called Judea 2,000 years ago. And then the Romans came and they moved them around into like the Mediterranean area. You have Italy and Spain and et cetera. And they wind up in North and Morocco. And then you always had the Jews from the first diaspora still living in the eastern countries of Iraq and Persia, India, etc. So then there's this like displacement, and Jews wind up in Europe. And what's with this Yiddish stuff? Why don't they just, like, Jews who move to Poland start speaking Polish like Jews in America do?
Well, that's an interesting question, and the answer is complicated.
We have time.
Scholars are actually kind of disagreed on this. The truth is that nowhere did Jews end up in mass speaking the language of the places where they lived, even the first diaspora. It's more understandable because it was much shorter in the first diaspora. But the second one, wherever they ended up, they spoke some sort of pidgin or patois of Hebrew, Aramaic, and the languages they encountered. This was also true when they settled along the Rhine River in Germany. Now, an interesting thing happened there in that they went to one place and then had to go kind of backtrack and go to a different place. By all accounts, or assumptions, really, scholars believe that they were speaking a kind of Judeo-German very, very early on, more than 1,000 years ago, when they first arrived in these kind of Germanic lands. And then once they went to Eastern Europe, they didn't stop speaking this kind of Hebrew, Aramaic, Middle German patois. And when they resettled in Eastern Europe, in isolation, it kind of became its own language and stopped being mutually intelligible.
Okay, this is pretty fascinating because, as you say, you have around the Mediterranean, for example, you have the Jews in Italy speak a Judeo-Italian, the Jews in France and in Spain speak Ladino, which is a Judeo-Spanish. The Jews along the top of North Africa speak a Judeo-Arabic. So wherever they seem to move, they seem to, like, forget about what was going next. Here it is. They moved to Germany. So you would think if they're moving to Poland, so they're going to stop speaking Judeo-German and you're now start speaking Judeo-Polish. But Yiddish carried away all the way through from Poland into the Balkans, into Russia. This is the language that Jews seem to adhere to in Europe. Any guesses to why this phenomenon attracted, why the Germans stuck with it?
Well, I'll say that any answer I could give you would be
purely speculative because you weren't there, yes.
Yeah. But the relative autonomy that Jews had in Eastern Europe, for better or for worse, I mean, they had the autonomy, but it was because nobody wanted to deal with them. Kind of ensured that they would be able to preserve their own language. There was a kind of positive autonomy early on in Poland, where Jews were allowed to kind of conduct their own affairs because they were welcome. Of course, in the Russian Empire, they were allowed to conduct their own affairs because they couldn't go to the police. But the kind of development of shtetlach and Jewish settlements in Jewish towns where either a majority or a significant minority of the population would be Jewish, along with the kind of linguistic mix that was happening in what was variously conquered by various duchies and empires, kind of allowed Yiddish to thrive and remain. Interestingly, you see a very similar thing happen in the modern era when you note the difference between Jews that came to the United States and Jews that ended up in Quebec. Jews that came to the United States were under enormous pressure to become like everyone else and largely lost their native languages relatively quickly. Whereas in Montreal, the kind of situation that was there already, in that people spoke different languages, there were people who spoke French, there were people who spoke English, and that was kind of the status quo, meant that Jews were under less pressure to assimilate for several reasons. One, because they didn't believe assimilation was possible. There was not much more anti-Semitism, but just there wasn't even a chance that they were going to end up being Canadians like other Canadians at the time. So Yiddish actually survived much longer, and these kind of Yiddish institutions survived longer in places like Montreal than they did in places like Cleveland.
Okay, it's interesting you brought this up because this actually was my next question. We spent, when I was younger, I spent 4 years in Australia, and the bulk of the Australian Jewish community were Holocaust survivors. So their children were people who were like my age, who spoke Yiddish because they would basically be the same generation as my mother's generation, whose parents were immigrants and came to America. But their kids also spoke Yiddish. They felt it necessary that their children were like my mother and Bubby. They spoke Yiddish so that I shouldn't understand, which if I picked it up anyway, I could understand them anyway. But the people in Australia, so they're teaching their kids Yiddish. They want their kids to be able to carry that on. And was it the melting pot theory that was the tone for that? Because I was thinking, what's so different about Australia? Excuse me, what's so different about Australia? But really the question is, what's so different about America then? Because we had this melting pot theory and just get in and become an American as soon as you possibly could.
Right. The melting pot, I've heard it described by some scholars as insidious tolerance.
Okay.
Or insidious acceptance. The melting pot is kind of it's no longer the politically appropriate thing to believe. It's multiculturalism is now the thing that's kind of in vogue. The melting pot essentially means to erase individuality, to erase, to a certain extent, one's culture in any way that would be inconvenient for the majority. So you could keep eating sushi, but stop being Shinto, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, understood. I mean, there's a joke, there's a linguist joke that goes something like, if a person speaks four languages, he's a polyglot, and if he speaks two languages, he's bilingual, and if he speaks language, what do you call him? American. Okay, maybe is that the reason why, or what would you attribute there has been over the last, we've been on the air for 20 years, and I would say over the last 15, 18 years, there has been this resurgent in Yiddish. I mean, you were very involved with the Yiddish Book Center in Massachusetts, and you have publishing new dictionaries, and universities are now teaching Yiddish classes as part of a curriculum. So is this something, are Jews collectively now waning nostalgic for this, the language of their bubbies?
Well, as much as I would like to say that that's no part of it, of course, I think that is some part of it. There is an enormous nostalgic impulse, I think, amongst American Jews. But I think there is something else to it as well. I think Jews, especially in the United States, I think the generation before mine, and maybe even the generation before yours, Rabbi, was almost defined by a central shame in their Jewishness. That, I mean, if you look at documents from certain Jewish movements, if you look at kind of how Jews are written about and how Jews, There's a specific article from the Atlantic Monthly from the 1930s by a woman who justifies her decision to fall in love with a Jewish man, which is one of my favorite artifacts of this kind of insidious shame. You know, he's a good man, even though he's a Jew, and his strange face, and he doesn't wear those silly hats like those other ones. He's more like us than he is like them, you see. So it's okay that I married him. And this was just normal. This was the idea. And I think now people, especially Jews, are feeling more able to kind of live without that shame. And it's an interesting thing that is almost, it's certainly not unique to Jews, but I think it's particular to a group of people who were never considered, for lack of a better term, white, but were kind of suddenly able to pass as white. James Baldwin, the famous African American author and scholar, actually wrote about this. It was an essay, I think it was called Why Blacks Don't Like Jews. And it was essentially blaming Jews for having abandoned their minority because they could. And this is kind of the you know, I mean, certainly talked about even in the Torah that a big part of why we remain small and why we remain diasporic is to be able to have this experience, and by abandoning that experience, it's a unique opportunity to do that in the United States, and it's very tempting. But I think nowadays that impulse is kind of reversing itself. People end up with nothing. There's, you know, hollowed out. There's nothing in the middle. They have this shell, but the center of their identity has been sort of forgotten. So when they look for it, they end up finding it. And it's much more comfortable to, it turns out, to not be constantly dogged by a discomfort one can't identify because of a terrible shame one's grandparents carried around and thereby obliterated their identities, and now you have to re-find it.
That's a fascinating idea. If you're just joining us, our guest today is Nachum Eichenhorn, who's a Yiddish scholar. And by the way, we'll be beginning a Yiddish class, a Yiddish conversation class, at Jewish Ferndale. Check the website for when it'll begin. It'll be Tuesdays at 7:30, and we're not exactly sure when it will start, but sometime this month, hopefully. This last week, we celebrated 100 years of the Balfour Declaration, granting Israel the right to exist, the state of Israel the right to exist. And the founding fathers of the Zionist movement, we're talking like Ben Yehuda and Theodor Herzl and et cetera, were very much opposed. They were European Jews, but they were very much opposed to the language of the street in Israel being Israel, and really pushed Hebrew. Would you say that that was a major setback for the promulgation of Yiddish then, Nachum?
I think it was one of the most major setbacks. In the very beginning of the Zionist movement, there was kind of this battle between the Yiddishists and the Hebraists. Pretty quickly, it became clear the Hebraists were going to be kind of the mainstream. At the beginning of the state, Yiddish was just practically speaking, very oppressed. People would, you know, the Palmach would smash Yiddish printing presses, and people would, you know, you would get tax breaks for printing in Hebrew, but you would get fined for printing in Yiddish. There were signs all over with, you know, these big, strong, fatigue-clad Jews that said, Hebrew, speak Hebrew. And I think there was this, I think it's rather subtle and complex why Hebrew was chosen.
Was Yiddish looked as being, course, let me just interrupt, was Yiddish looked as, say, like the language of the oppressed people and Hebrew was the language of the liberated people?
I think that's a simple way of putting it. I think, yeah, that's the essential conflict. But it's even more than that. Yiddish was the language of Jewy Jews. If you look at early Hebrew poetry, when it talks about kind of what was going on in Europe versus what was going on in then British Mandate Palestine, it was, oddly enough, an assimilationist exercise. The early Zionists wanted nothing more than to be a nation among nations. They didn't want to be special or different or strange. They wanted to kind of assimilate the, you know, Daniel Boyarin talks about this in his wonderful book. I'm forgetting the title of his book, but it's about the perception of manliness in Jewish culture for the past several thousand years.
So if the Israelis could have Hebrew as a language, not rely on Yiddish, which that was sort of like this European amalgam, that would indicate that Israel was a real country and not just some fall away from something that fell out of Europe.
And not just that. It was a real country, and that these men were men and not just Jews.
That's fascinating.
They weren't weak and backward and Yiddish speaking and Talmud learning. They were men with strong arms and guns and shovels and farming. And it was, you know, there's this concept of the new Jew. Hebrew was the language of the new Jew as well as the old Jew, which is why you see early Zionists would name their children names that were not very traditional, because they were the names of biblical villains. But they would be named them because those biblical characters were great warriors. And that was more important than being named, say, David or Solomon. They would name their kids Nimrod or, you know, these names of great non-Jewish warriors in the Bible.
Mm-hmm. I didn't come across any Goliaths in my travels, but yeah, I can understand.
No, there's
what you're saying.
No.
I can understand that. Okay.
Well, you can never know. You can't name a kid Goliath if he turns out 5'2". It's going to be, you know,
it'll be really
I'll never
bad.
Hear the end of it.
Yeah, that'll be really bad for the kid too. So, okay, so now you're a not only just a scholar, a student of Yiddish, but you're also a teacher of Yiddish. So a person wants to learn a new language. So they have these things they're called, some languages are called hard languages to learn, and some other languages are called easy languages to learn. But I suppose when it comes to learning, once you learned it already, it's now easy. So where would you classify, like, the idea of if a person wants to take a class and to be able to actually say, well, I can speak Yiddish somewhat now. I can make myself understood.
Well, linguistically, it all depends on the language you come from. But since all of my students so far have come from English, it's very easy, actually. I think it's one of the easiest languages to learn for an English speaker. You know, they say one of the easiest languages to learn is Spanish, but I would say Yiddish is even easier than Spanish.
I happen to have learned both of those, and I happen to agree with you. Yiddish is much easier than Spanish.
Yeah, the kind of underlying grammatical structure is because both English and Yiddish come from a kind of middle high German grammatical structure. It's very similar. It's kind of intuitive. You figure it out very, very quickly. And once you have that underlying structure very, very quickly, it becomes a matter of vocabulary. Although there is this, there are slight differences. And of course, the handy trick that a student taught me is that if you imagine, you know, you'll begin to say sentences in your native language's grammar that end up sounding a little strange in the target language. So one of my students says, oh, here's how I fix that. I imagine it coming out of the mouth of an old Jewish man, and however he would say it is the right Yiddish grammar.
So the person was doing, instead of translating English to Yiddish, they're translating Yinglish to.
Right.
Got it. Understood. When I was in high school, so I was debated with the idea of speaking German, and I spoke to the German teacher, and I said, well, I speak Yiddish, and they said, I don't think you want to speak. I don't think you want to take German, because it's just going to confuse the heck out of you. Because he told me, he says, there's a guy who came to hear a German lecture, and after an hour and a half, he apologized that he had to leave before the verb. So you don't have that kind of like German structure in grammar in Yiddish, that sideways way of talking from English. It is more English based.
Yeah, it's definitely more natural feeling. And there's options in a way. The kind of like English in Yiddish. You can construct a sentence in one of several ways. In German, there's one correct way, and you'll sound strange if you kind of deviate from it. You can figure out like how people would speak in Yiddish, but it's kind of like the harmonica. It's easy to learn and hard to master.
Mm-hmm. That's true. When I was first learning Yiddish back in yeshiva, it took me, I would say, about 2 years of like some serious effort, and I would say I was communicating in Yiddish properly with all the native born Yiddish speakers. So I went to a rabbi and I said to him, "Can you give me some rules of grammar in speaking Yiddish?" And he said, "There is one rule of grammar. If it sounds like Yiddish, it's Yiddish. And if it doesn't sound like Yiddish, it's not Yiddish." So, which case I just like laughed at him and said, "No, but really." And he said, "That's the way that I learned it." So are there definite rules in Yiddish grammar?
There are some kind of big rules like there are in English. But I think they're kind of easily picked up. There are big rules. You know, there's certain word order, the verb usually comes as the second clause in a sentence, things like that. But not nearly as many as, say, German or Russian.
Okay. Now, and also then with vocabulary, there's we recently received a copy of a brand new Yiddish dictionary. I forget who it was that did it. It's two volumes, and it has a companion one volume English to Yiddish dictionary. It seems like there's a whole, even though some of the words are very long, but it seems like there's a whole lot less words in Yiddish than there is in English. Not so many synonyms, as you might say.
Well, it really depends on the subject. So there are areas of life in which Yiddish has many more words than English, and areas where it has very, very few. So if you want to talk about, I mean, and these things are, I'd say, intimately connected with the breadth of Jewish life, especially in Europe. So there are areas of life where you don't really need words in Yiddish because it's taken care of in another language. Like, there are very few Yiddish words for different species of plant.
Okay.
So there's very few botanical terminology because you have a tree, you have a bush. You have a bush that's poisonous, you have a bush you eat, and that's it. Knowing more than that isn't necessary to live life as a Jew.
Yeah, and an apple
However,
in Yiddish is an apple.
There are four or five words for thinking. There's three words for arguing, for different types of arguing. And there's eight different words for potato.
Okay. I guess the different types. And like, unlike America, there were 50 words for drunk in English. How many words are there for drunk in Yiddish? I only know of one. And that's shikr. So, because Jews didn't get drunk, you know, so.
Yeah, Jews didn't get drunk.
Indeed.
So it really depends. However, there's a kind of translator's rule of thumb. The vocabulary and verbosity are not necessarily the same. If you have one page in English, to translate it into Hebrew, it'll turn out to be a paragraph and a half. To translate it into Yiddish, it'll be four pages.
Right, but because it's a different language. I mean, because it's a long language. So, indeed.
Yeah, you tend to use more words in Yiddish.
Indeed. But, okay, we're going to have to wrap it up at this point. So, again, our guest today has been Nachum Eichenhorn, who is a Yiddish scholar, and will be teaching classes at Jewish Ferndale Tuesday nights, 7:30, and you can go to the website and find out when that's going to begin. We're hoping. And, Nachum, how soon do you envision we should be starting? Today's like the 4th or 5th of November already, and when do you think we could be up and running? A couple weeks?
I would say, next couple weeks.
Before Thanksgiving.
I should think so.
Okay, so if you have any questions about that, you can go to jewishferndale.com. You can drop me a line, and we'll be in touch. And there's a whole plethora of classes which are now ongoing and starting at Jewish Ferndale. Check the calendar. It's all listed right there. You have to scroll down to the bottom of the Jewish Ferndale page to get to the calendar, and you'll see all kinds of wonderful things. Thank you for coming. This is. I've had lots of people talk about Yiddish over the last 20 years. This is probably the most enlightening. But I do have one question. This is my mother's pet peeve. How do you say sweater in Yiddish? Nahum.
Sweater.
How do you say sweater?
First of all, the answer that I think my Yiddish teacher would give is, first of all, sweaters are goyish. Second of all, there's different ways. I think people would say shredded in
right.
like a modern street Yiddish. You okay. wouldn't say schwitzer.
No one would call it a schwitzer.
Yeah, if that's what you're asking.
No, because in Australia, where I was, the way that they say it's sweater was jumper, which is how you say it in Australian. When you're in Australia, you get cold, you put on a jumper. And there's no J in Yiddish. You have to take three letters to make a J sound, a D,
right.
an SH, and a Z. You know, and put them all together and you get J. So this was like one of my mother's, like, she spoke a wonderful Yiddish,
well,
but said there's no word in Yiddish for sweater. And it might be interesting because...
Actually, I mean, there's actually, this is one of those things, to close it out, where there are several words in Yiddish for the same thing. And they usually come from a different language. So, which is why in modern kind of Hasidic Yiddish, the word would be shredded. But there are older terms, like there's different words in Russian that would have been used in the Russian Empire. There are different things like that. So there's like svita and sermega and shimul and a lot of different things that meant different kinds of sweaters.
Okay, fascinating. So I'm fascinated by this, and I hope you are too, enough to sign up for the course. And thank you very much. Thank you for coming on. This has been very enlightening, very entertaining, and we love it. And people want to learn more, come to the class. Thank you so much, Nahum.
Come to the class. Thank you, Rabbi.
We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Schulfeman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have up for your listening pleasure. This is Sandy Shmueli. The song is called, this is from his new CD. The song is called Mimkoimech Malkeinu, which is taken from the Shabbos morning liturgy. It means your place, our king, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Let's listen to Sandy Shmueli.
Let's ולנצח נצחי. בינינו תירנה מלכותיך, כדבר האמור בשירי וזכר על ידי דוד משיח צדקך.
Want assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale. Herschel Finman, you're listening to the Jewish Hour. Up next, this group is called the Klez Dispenser, and the song is called, I like this group because it's got a tuba. That's just why, you know, I picked it, but it's called the Hamish of Bulger. That was really awesome. That was the Klezmer Dispenser. What an interesting name for a group. But and the Hamish of Bulger. Up next. Well, it's still kind of sort of people still thinking about Hanukkah a little bit. It's still the season. you know, whatever happens to be. So this is Shir Shalom. This is their piece that they did for 2017. It's called An Elvis Hanukkah. I'll let you guess why.
Candles burn, let's rock. Everybody, let's rock. And the party was so gishmack as we dance in the Hanukkah rock. They wapped it, wap, shawad, wap, shawad. I have a little dreidel. I made it out of clay. When it's dry and ready, oh, dreidel, I shall play. So, let's gather around this table. We'll give you a treat. A civvy bone to play with and latkes to eat. A civvy bone. So. Chag Simcha hu la'am. Nes gadol ha'yasham. We light the candles for each great night. We watch them burn and shine so bright. We dance and sing around the lights of Hanukkah. I'm all lit up.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Joel Finman, you are listening to the Jewish Hour. This week is the portion of Vayechi. It's Genesis 48, for those of you who are following along at home. And it discusses the end of Jacob's life. We look at the end of the portion. Jacob's already passed away. He's already buried in Mamre's Machpelah and the Cave of the Patriarchs and all of the drama that went with that. At the end of the portion, the brothers throw themselves at the feet of Joseph and say, listen, we know you weren't going to hurt us when, or do anything to us when our father was alive, because that would have caused our father grief because there was fighting between us and you. But now that he's not here, there's nothing preventing you from that. We're ready to do whatever you do. Just don't hurt us. Don't make our lives miserable. So Joseph says, what are you talking about? You're my brothers. I love you. Listen, everything's divine providence. If you hadn't sold me, what would have happened? Our father would have been brought down in chains to Egypt and would have spent the last 17 years of his life in misery. But here it is. So listen, the Almighty sets things up. No hard feelings. The fact that I spent 13 years in a pit and didn't take a bath all that time. No hard feelings. Listen, I get to be second to the king. And at this point, Joseph had amassed a massive fortune. It was probably worth $7 billion or several billion dollars that he had amassed. He was in control of the world's superpower. He had the world at his disposal. He had it good. So he said, listen, you guys, you go live in Goshen. I have to live over here in the city. I still got to run a country. And it describes and says that about Joseph's two children and Ephraim and Manasseh, when we bless our children, when we bless our sons, we say, may the Lord make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. For a very good reason, in that Ephraim and Manasseh were the first brothers mentioned in the Bible that didn't fight. So we bless our sons. Listen, you should get along with your brothers, please. I can tell you stories about what my older brothers used to do to me. Never mind. So Joseph said, I'll take care of you. And he sent them off to Goshen, and he did take care of them. He never spoke to them ever again. He really didn't want anything to do with them. He was not their buddy. You know, they still did set him in a pit full of scorpions and snakes, and he did get sold into slavery and did spend 13 years in a prison pit. So, but he was on good terms with them. It says, listen, you know, we'll peacefully coexist. We'll take good care of you. You'll always be good. Then it says at the very end of the portion that Joseph died at the age of 110. Now, we're thinking 110. Well, that's pretty cool. That's flipped out, you know. So, but not for biblical. No, that's way short. His father, who had a miserable life, lived to be 147. And how miserable? When he was 130, Jacob was asked by Pharaoh, how old are you? Because he looked ancient. You know, there's people walking around. I don't know how old they are already at that point, but he looked ancient. It was like, whoa, I can't believe there's somebody that, because of what he went through. And he died 30 years younger than his father, almost 40 years younger than his father. Joseph, same deal. He only lived to be 110. In Judaism, we wish each other that you should live to be 120. It says Fiorello LaGuardia was once honored by, I think, the UJA. He was a former mayor of New York. Everybody loved Fiorello LaGuardia. They named an airport after him, which is now being revamped and hopefully will be a modern airport sometime the next time I have to fly, hopefully, God willing. So he said, you know, Jews are smarter than Italians. Italians, when we make a toast, we say, to 100 years, 100 years. Jews, we wish each other you should live to be 120. So Moses lived to be 120, and he's considered to have lived a full life. Joseph only lived 110 years. Why? Stress. He had to run a country. Simple as that. What we have to do, where am I going with all this? I'm sure, I mean, Joseph is referred to his, everybody in the Bible has a title named after their name. Joseph is called Joseph HaTzadik, Joseph the righteous person. I'm sure that Joseph spent time engaged in study and self-improvement and relaxing and taking care of himself. But we have to know what the dangers of stress really are in our own lives. And if we think the reason we wake up in the morning is in order to go to work, think again. Work is a tool by which we get to fill in the blank. The main reason why we go to work is in order to afford ourselves a proper livelihood so that we can live as proper people, so that we can, as the case may be, send our kids to a proper school, give enough charity, perform and live the ways that Jews are supposed to live. That's the deal. And in doing so, the stresses of work are not stresses of work. It's more like, have I fulfilled my commitments to charity? Am I learning enough? That's really what people should be gauged at. When people ask me people ask you, what do you do for a living? You should say, I learn with Finman for an hour. And says, that's what you do for a living? Yes. Do I make money that way? No, but that's what I do for a living. That's what this beleptman is, the Yiddish word. That makes me alive. Speaking of alive, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard. The Specs Howard School of Media Arts is proud to have been a sponsor of The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding comes from its sponsors, listeners like you help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. That's 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. Your help is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Hey, Finman here. You are listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? Easiest way? Go to rabbifinman.com. Let's get right to the point. What are you going to see at rabbifinman.com? You'll be able to contact me. You'll listen to the shows. Various archived editions going back 2 years. Thank you very much, JCAS Network. Archived editions of the E-Parsha, U-Parsha, Hasidic U Story, all ways in which we convey Judaism in an entertaining and informative manner, and the donations page. I've been chomping at the bit for the last hour to let people know, yes, we paid off October. So this month, we paid off September and October. So all we have to do is pay off November and December. But guess what? Next week is January. So we're going to have to pay off November, December, and January next week, unless, listen, I can't believe how people came in. Keep those cards and letters coming, folks. With just like a big whoosh, October is history. So we appreciate it. It's really very heartwarming when people send in their donations for the Jewish Hour and say how much they appreciate. The warm feedback just gladdens my heart. So go to rabbifinman.com, go to the donations page, type in any amount you like, pick amount, it's all safe, secure through PayPal. If you want to get it in on this year, you only got a couple more days left to the end of the week to get it in on this week. Who knows what's going to be with the tax structure next week? You might just benefit to do it today. So go to the computer and do it. Don't like doing internet giving? Understood. Send your donation in any amount to The Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. Get it in today. Okay, very quick story. There was a person, his name was Jerry Simon. Jerry Simon decided he was going to be a pioneer, and he moved to Israel in 1967 after the Six-Day War. And they had him, of course, working on a kibbutz. And he was working with a guy by the name of Yehuda Feinerman, okay? And they're working, they're doing whatever they're doing at this agricultural kibbutz. And Jerry notices Yehuda's tattoo on his arm, which was many Israelis at that time had numbers, as they were Holocaust survivors. And he said, tell me the story about the number. He says, what are you talking about? What's the big deal, my number? All Holocaust survivors have numbers. And he said, the number 7416. I said, that's the last four digits of my social security number. So he said, like, big deal. You know how I can just imagine this Israeli saying, big deal. You know, so what? So he said, tell me the story. So he said that his family was all lined up, and they went to the internment camp, and they were all given his numbers in order, father, mother, sisters, brother. He said he was the next to last. And he got this number, 7416. And that was that, you know. So Jerry worked on the kibbutz for a little bit of time, got smart, realized that he could do better things than pick avocados and clean pens. So he went to Jerusalem and became a social worker, an INTEP worker for one of the Jewish agencies there. He was given a job in about 1973, following the Yom Kippur War, to go escort this wealthy American businessman. And He picks up the business man at the airport and they're driving to Jerusalem. This guy is just obnoxious. He's just barking commands and he's just like he's just like, Jerry's just about had it. He's up to here. And I just put my hand over my head. You couldn't see that, but that was just, I just tell stories and that's, I just move my hands. And suddenly the man in the back seat says, pull over. So he pulled over and said, what do you want? And he said, I have to get out of the car. I have to tell you something. He said, you think I'm an obnoxious businessman. What I am is really is a Holocaust survivor. I have nobody in the world. And with this, the man was standing there. He's wearing short sleeves. And Jerry noticed the number, and it said 7417. One more than the number. He said, you're not alone. You have a brother. And I know where he is. This week is the Fast of Tevis. It's the 10th day of Tevis. It celebrates or commemorates the day that the walls of Jerusalem were breached by Nebuchadnezzar. That's going to be on the Thursday morning, Sunday at sunrise to sunset, or dawn to dusk, as the case may be. So have an easy fast. We thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope you had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. We hope to see you back again next week.